Good morning, Auroville. This is Abhijit with you again, and I'm broadcasting from Auroville Radio. And I'm back with my series on exploring education in arts, animation, and filmmaking. Today, I'm picking up another topic in filmmaking. And today's topic is post-World War I American cinema. Till now, we have explored the pre-World War I American and European cinema in the silent era. And we continue with that during the 1920s. So during the 1920s, in the United States, motion picture production, distribution, and exhibition became a major national industry, and movies perhaps the major national obsession. The salaries of stars reached monumental proportions. Filmmaking practices and narrative formulas were standardized to accommodate mass production, and Wall Street began to invest heavily in every branch of the business. The growing industry was organized according to the studio system that, in many respects, the producer, Thomas Harper Ince, had developed between 1914 and 1918 in Inceville, his studio in the Santa Ynez Canyon near Hollywood. Ince functioned as the central authority over multiple production units, each headed by a director who was required to shoot an assigned film according to a detailed continuity script. Every project was carefully budgeted and tightly scheduled, and Ince himself supervised the final cut. The central producer system was the prototype for the studio system of the 1920s, and with some modifications, it prevailed as the dominant mode of Hollywood production for the next 40 years. Virtually all the major film genres evolved and were codified during the 1920s, but none was more characteristic of the period than the slapstick comedy. This form was originated by Mack Sennett, who at his Keystone Studios produced countless one- and two-reel shorts and features, namely Tilly's Punctured Romance in 1914, The Surf Girl in 1916, Teddy at the Throttle in 1917, whose narrative logic was subordinated to fantastic, purely visual humor. An anarchic mixture of circus, vaudeville, burlesque, pantomime, and the chase. Sennett's Keystone comedies created a world of inspired madness and mayhem, and they employed the talents of such future stars as Charlie Chaplin, Harry Langdon, Roscoe Arbuckle, Mabel Normand, and Harold Lloyd. When these performers achieved fame, many of them left Keystone, often to form their own production companies, a practice still possible in the early 1920s. Chaplin, for example, who had developed the persona of the Little Tramp at Keystone, went on to direct and star in a series of shorts produced by SNA in 1915, namely The Tramp and A Night in the Show, and Mutual between 1916 and 1917, namely The Vagabond, The AM, The Rink, and Easy Street. In 1917, he was offered an 8-film contract with First National that enabled him to establish his own studio. He directed his first feature there, the semi-autobiographical The Kid, in 1921. But most of his First National films were two-reelers. In 1919, Chaplin, D.W. Griffith, Mary Pickford, and Douglas Fairbanks, the four most popular and powerful film artists of the time, jointly formed the United Artists Corporation in order to produce and distribute, and thereby retain artistic and financial control over their own films. Chaplin directed three silent features for the United Artists: A Woman in Paris in 1923, his great comic epic, The Gold Rush, in 1925, and The Circus in 1928, which were released after the introduction of sound into motion pictures. He later made several sound films, but the two most successful, his first two, City Lights in 1931 and Modern Times in 1936, were essentially silent films with musical scores. Buster Keaton possessed a kind of comic talent very different from Chaplin's, but both men were wonderfully subtle actors with a keen sense of the tragic often contained within the comic. And both were major directors of their period. Keaton, like Chaplin, was born into a theatrical family and began performing in vaudeville skits at a young age. Intrigued by the new film medium, he left the stage and worked for 2 years as a supporting comedian to Arbuckle's production company. In 1919, Keaton formed his own production company, where over the next 4 years he made 20 shorts, including One Week in 1920, The Boat in 1921, Cops in 1922, and The Balloonatic in 1923, that represent, with Chaplin's Mutual Film, the acme of American slapstick comedy. A Keaton trademark was the trajectory gag, in which perfect timing of acting, directing, and editing propels his film character through a geometric progression of complicated side gags that seem impossibly dangerous but are still dramatically logical. Such routines inform all of Keaton's major films: Our Hospitality in 1923, Sherlock Jr. in 1924, The Navigator in 1924, Seven Chances in 1925, his masterpiece The General in 1927, and Steamboat Bill Jr. in 1928. Keaton's greatest films, all made before his company was absorbed by MGM, have a reflexive quality that indicates his fascination with film as a medium. Although some of his MGM films were financially successful, the factory-like studio system stifled Keaton's creativity and he was reduced to playing bit parts after the early 1930s. Important but lesser-known comics were Lloyd, the team of Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy, Langdon, and Arbuckle. Working at the Hal Roach Studios, Lloyd cultivated the persona of an earnest, sweet-tempered boy next door. He specialized in a variant of Keystone Mayhem known as the Comedy of Thrills, in which, as in Lloyd's most famous feature, Safety Last in 1923 and The Freshman in 1925, an innocent protagonist finds himself placed in physical danger. Laurel and Hardy also worked for Roach. They made 27 two-reelers, including Putting Pants on Philip in 1927 and Liberty in 1929, and became even more popular in the 1930s in such sound films as Another Fine Mess in 1930 and Sons of the Desert in 1933. Their comic characters were basically grown-up children whose relationship was sometimes disturbingly sadomasochistic. Langdon also traded on a childlike, even baby-like image in such popular features as The Strong Man in 1926 and Long Pants in 1927, both directed by Frank Capra. Arbuckle, however, in his few years of stardom, created the character of a leering sensual adult. Arbuckle's talent was limited, but his persona affected the course of American film history in quite unexpected way. Arbuckle was at the center of the most damaging scandal to affect American motion pictures during the silent era. In September 1921, the comedian and several friends hosted a weekend party in San Francisco Hotel. During the party, a woman became ill and she later died in a hospital. Press reports of the event as a drunken orgy inflamed public opinion, and amid the volatile social transformations of the post-World War I era, with issues such as immigration restriction and the national prohibition of alcoholic beverages, deeply divided the country. Many had come to regard movies as a disturbing instigator of social change and its high living stars as threats to moral order and values. The Arbuckle scandal seemed to encapsulate these fears, and prosecutors responded by accusing the actor of rape and murder. Eventually indicted for manslaughter, he was tried 3 times. The first 2 trials ended in hung juries, and in the third, the jury deliberated for 6 minutes and voted for acquittal. But Arbuckle's career as an actor was in ruins. He was banned from the screen for more than a decade. Other sensational deaths involving Hollywood personalities through murder or suicide or drug overdose fueled the public fervor. To stave off increasing efforts by state and local governments to censor films, the Hollywood studios formed a new, stronger trade association, the Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America, also known as MPPDA, later renamed the Motion Picture Association of America, also known as MPAA, as we know it today. They also hired a conservative politician, U.S. Postmaster General Will H. Hayes, as its head. The Hayes office, as the association became popularly known, advocated industry self-regulation as an alternative to governmental interference, and it succeeded in preventing the expansion of censorship efforts. Hayes popularized a series of documents that attempted to regulate various forms of criminal and immoral behavior depicted in movies. In principle, such as compensating values, for example, recognized that popular entertainment had always told stories of law-breaking and social transgression, but it held the law and morality should always triumph in a film. The leading practitioner of compensating values formula was the flamboyant director Cecil B. DeMille. He first became famous after World War I for a series of sophisticated comedies of manners that were aimed at Hollywood's new middle-class audience. Old Wives for New in 1918, Forbidden Fruit in 1921. When the Hayes office was established, DeMille turned to the religious spectacles that made him an international figure, notably the Ten Commandments in 1923, which he himself remade in 1956. DeMille's chief rival was the German emigre Ernest Lubitz. An early master of the UFA costume film, Lubitz excelled at sexual innuendo and understatement in such urban essays as The Marriage Circle in 1924. Also popular during the 1920s were the swashbuckling exploits of Douglas Fairbanks, whose lavish adventure spectacles, including Robin Hood in 1922 and The Thief of Baghdad in 1924, thrilled a generation, and the narrative documentaries of Robert Flaherty, whose Nanu of the North in 1922 and Moana in 1926 were unexpectedly successful with the public and with critics. The most enigmatic and unconventional figure working in Hollywood at the time, however, was without a doubt the Viennese emigre Erich von Stroheim. Stroheim, who also acted, learned directing as an assistant to Griffith on Intolerance and Hearts of the World. His first three films, Blind Husbands in 1918, The Devil's Passkey in 1919, and Foolish Wives in 1922, constitute an obsessive trilogy of adultery. Each features a romantic triangle in which an American wife is seduced by a Peruvian army officer. Even though all three films were enormously popular, the great sums Stroheim was spending on the extravagant production design and costuming of his next project brought him into conflict with his Universal producers, and he was replaced. Stroheim then signed a contract with Goldwyn Pictures and began work on a long-cherished project, an adaptation of Frank Norris's grim, naturalistic novel, McTeague. Shot entirely on location in the streets and rooming houses of San Francisco, in Death Valley, and in the California hills, the film was conceived as a sentence-by-sentence translation of its source. Stroheim's original version ran approximately 10 hours. Realizing that the film was too long to be exhibited, he cut almost half the footage. The film was still deemed too long, so Stroheim, with the help of director Rex Ingram, edited it down into a four-hour version that could be shown in two parts. By this time, however, Goldwyn Pictures had merged with Metro Pictures and Louis B. Mayer Pictures to become MGM. MGM took the negative from Stroheim and cut another 2 hours, destroying the excised footage in the process. Released as Greed in 1924, the film had enormous gaps in continuity, but it was still recognized as a work of genius in its rich psychological characterization and in its creation of a naturalistic analog of the novel. Stroheim made one more film for MGM, a darkly satiric adaptation of the Franz Lehár operetta The Merry Widow in 1925. He then went on to Celebrity Pictures, where he directed The Wedding March in 1928, a two-part spectacle set in Imperial Vienna, but his work was taken from him and recut into a single film when Celebrity was absorbed by Paramount. Stroheim's last directorial duties were on the botched Queen Kelly 1929 and Walking Down Broadway in 1932. Although he was removed from both films for various reasons, he made his living thereafter by writing screenplays and acting. Although many of Stroheim's troubles with Hollywood were personal, he was also a casualty of the American film industry's transformation during the 1920s from a spectacular entrepreneurial enterprise into a vertically and horizontally integrated oligopoly that had no tolerance for creative difference. His situation was not unique. Many singular artists, including Griffith, Sennett, Chaplin, and Keaton, found it difficult to survive as filmmakers under the rigidly standardized studio system that had been established by the end of the decade. The industry's conversion to sound at that time reinforced its big business tendencies and further discouraged independent filmmakers. The studios, which had borrowed huge sums of money on the very brink of the Great Depression in order to finance the conversion, were determined to reduce production cost and increase efficiency. They therefore became less and less willing to tolerate artistic innovation and eccentricity. That brings us to the end of today's episode. Thank you for tuning in.
This is Auroville Radio, voices from the city of Dome.